From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Osama bin Laden is dead. Happy days. Happy days, everybody. This is the greatest night of my career.
That's Geraldo Rivera last Sunday night breaking the story to Fox News viewers that Osama bin Laden had been killed. About an hour later, at 11:35 p.m., 56.5 million Americans watched President Obama deliver the news officially. As Obama finished his speech and walked away from the camera down a long hallway, reporters everywhere started digging for details. By midweek, the White House had released more information about the operation, much of which was corrected. Bin Laden was armed when he was killed. And then he wasn't. Bin Laden used his own wife as a human shield. No, he hadn't. CIA Director Leon Panetta said that a photo would be released of bin Laden's corpse, and then the administration said that actually it hadn't yet decided. Then it did decide. Not to. White House Press Secretary Jay Carney.
The fact of the matter is, as the president described, these are graphic photographs of someone who was shot in the face, or the head, rather, and it is not in our national security interests to allow those images to become icons to rally opinion against the United States. And further, because he believes, as he said so clearly, this is not who we are.
Or are we? 56% of the people polled by CNN said the picture should be released. Presumably, if you polled pundits, that number would be even higher. Or at least louder.
They will be leaked at some point by somebody, and it will be embarrassing to the United States.
Get the pictures out because, there are elements of Al-Qaeda around the world, and they ought to be on alert that, you know, if they got him, they could get me.
By the way, I have no doubt that we got bin Laden. I just want our enemies to know that we did, too. The picture is the price tag.
Journalists are often total freaks for disclosure. Except for New Yorker staff writer Philip Gurevich, who recently argued against the official release of the photographs. Meanwhile, Paul Waldman, senior correspondent for the American Prospect, believes we should get to see at least one photo of bin Laden's corpse as a visual bookend to the series of ghastly images the war on terror has brought us. We've invited them both. Philip, Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.
Paul Waldman, you think the moment does need to be documented by an image. Why?
If you think about the images that get repeated of Osama bin Laden, there are really three that stand out. The first one is him kneeling down and shooting an AK-47. Everybody's seen that. That displays him as a warrior engaged in this large epic battle. The second image that we've also all seen is him trudging through the mountains of Afghanistan. What that communicates is his cleverness and resilience and America's impotence. The final image, perhaps the one that we see the most often when bin Laden is shown, is him speaking into a microphone. And this shows him as a leader. There's an implied audience on the other side of that microphone. I think it would be tremendously useful to replace those images with one that shows a kind of a finality to this whole episode in history. It doesn't have to be the gruesome one of his face with a bullet hole in it. It could be the image of his body being pushed into the sea. Think about what would happen if they released especially just one photo. Immediately, it would be on newspapers in every country in the world. It would be on thousands of websites. It would lead every news broadcast. It would probably be almost instantaneously the most reproduced photograph in history.
Philip Gurevich, you think that is true and probably exactly the reason not to release it?
I assume that the photograph will come out at some point in some way. It may very well come out from a Freedom of Information Act request. What I thought would be totally unwise would be for the Obama White House to release the photograph as an official document at this particular moment as a photo finish on the killing of bin Laden. And I think that the picture that we have of the president standing before the microphone in the White House in the drama of the moment, calling a special national television broadcast and speaking with cool intensity about what was done, that's an incredibly powerful image of the killing of bin Laden. There is no particular need at this point for the president to hoist his head on a stick and parade it in the street. And that's what anybody who wants these pictures released is essentially calling for, whether that's what they believe they would like to see or not.
Fair enough. But there was bin Laden the man and bin Laden the mythic figure displayed on jihadi websites, you know, in storefronts in Karachi. Why wouldn't a photograph of a middle-aged dead man served to demolish that myth of Osama bin Laden.
This would be an image of us. We would be putting this out as an official image. And when you put out an image of the violence you commit, it's part of the way that you're projecting your power and your idea of yourself to the world. You say they've been putting these images on their websites. And for far too much of the war on terror in the last decade, America had sought to fight terror with terror, fight barbarism with barbarism. And what Obama said when he gave his interview explaining why he wasn't releasing the photographs at this point, what he said basically is, that's not what we do. That's not who we are. We don't do trophies.
What about transparency, though? Paul, does it behoove the government to document this death in the most graphic terms?
It doesn't have to be in the most graphic terms, but I think at the most basic level, it's true that we should always default to transparency. You know, when the Obama administration took office, they reversed a Bush policy on Freedom of Information Act requests that in the Bush years essentially said that the default setting was that requests should be denied and delayed. And when Obama took office, they essentially said that unless there's a really powerful, compelling reason like privacy or national security, that we would release information that the press or researchers or anybody else wanted. Images from this period of our history are going to persist. And as Philip said, there are a lot of very damaging images that have come out. We have the photographs from Abu Ghraib. There was a photograph in the early stages of the Iraq War of a young boy who had both of his arms blown off by a bombing that was re-shown around the world and generated a lot of anger against the United States. It would be, especially if the image that we put out of bin Laden's death was one that was respectful, like him shrouded in a burial shroud being put into the ocean, it would communicate that this period of our history is over, and especially in the context of what's happening in the Middle East now, that bin Laden and his ideology are done. Otherwise, those other images that have done so much damage to the United States, they're going to persist. And so I think it's important to put a kind of visual bookend on this period that they have the opportunity to do now.
I don't believe that this period of our history is over. I think that this period of our history is very much with us. I think that it's purely wishful thinking to imagine that an image showing a shrouded corpse being dropped into the ocean would put any kind of closure to this. It seems like that of all images, the rapid and slightly bizarre disposal of this body, I think that would stir things up. And I think that there's a very important distinction to be made between the images from Abu Ghraib and the images, for instance, of civilian victims. Those had tremendous news value. They showed us something that we were not otherwise fully conscious of. There's no news value in the photograph of bin Laden. In the name of transparency, you speak of it, and I say, well, the White House has been actually changing its story almost unprompted at times.
I want to ask you about that very thing, especially considering how the government's narrative about the events in Abbottabad and in Washington, for that matter, continue to change with every passing hour, it seems. Isn't there an argument for that reason alone to document the very event that this country has paid for so dearly over the past decade in blood and treasure?
But why would the man's head on a stake? And why is an official release? And that was what I was going to say. The photographs from Abu Ghraib were unofficial photographs. And when they were released, they were declared a crime by the government at that time. The photographs themselves, the act of taking them and the act of leaking them and the act of having them and their existence, they were criminal acts. That's very different from an official release of a piece of information that we essentially know, which offers no news information. It's pure sensation. It may provide satisfaction for some, and it may provide distress for others, but I'm not sure why in either case that's a service that the White House should be in the business of providing.
Paul, you talked about bookends and closure. Tell me how this would achieve closure.
Well, I think it would be a mistake to assume that it has to be done in a kind of triumphalist sort of way. And we've certainly seen that in the past. You know, you might remember when Saddam Hussein was caught, Paul Bremer came in front of a press conference and almost shouted, "Ladies and gentlemen, we got him." When Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was caught, they did a press conference where they blew up the picture of his dead body to poster size. So far, the Obama administration has been extremely somber. And that was certainly true of the announcement when Obama made it, but there was nothing about that that communicates the actual event. If I showed you a picture of that, you wouldn't know what it was. It would just be President Obama at a microphone. As we move through time into the years and decades ahead, those images are going to be an important part of what lasts in our memory. We didn't need the photograph of the Marines raising the flag at Iwo Jima to make us understand that we had won World War II, but it communicated a great deal about what we understood about that event, what it was supposed to represent, what it was supposed to tell us about us.
The image of Iwo Jima is exactly the opposite. It happens also to be a staged reenactment, as we now know, but it's an image of American soldiers triumphing over intense adversity at the end of a grueling battle, hoisting their flag in pride over their nation. What you're talking about is a headshot of Hitler with his brains blown out and showing. We don't have that, and I don't think there's been a failure to achieve closure on World War II in the absence of it. I don't see the need. I think it's a very odd notion, and it's not by any means yours alone. This notion that somehow the picture will crystallize this event in a way that no other form of narrative, no other form of news. Photography, it's an incredibly wonderful medium, but it's one of the most limited frames through which you can look at the world in a split frozen second of time. And it's also one of the most manipulable. So to reduce all that's outside the frame, you asked earlier, Bob, about the changing story at the White House. None of that would be reflected in a headshot of Osama bin Laden's corpse.
Philip keeps characterizing this in sort of the most gruesome and triumphalist terms, as if that's necessarily how they would have to do it. They've been very somber about this up until now. And if they released now one picture, let's say, of the body being put into the ocean, that would become the iconic picture that represents this event, even if all the other photos get released later on. So I think they have an opportunity now to do it on the best possible terms instead of on the worst possible terms.
Paul Waldman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Philip Gurevich, thank you.
Thanks.
Paul Waldman is a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. Philip Gurevich is a staff writer for The New Yorker.
Coming up, jihadi websites react, and we consider the long and varied legacy of Osama bin Laden in pop culture, both here and around the world.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and executives protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Friday, a website identified with al-Qaeda confirmed Osama bin Laden's death. But the initial reaction to his death on jihadist websites was mostly disbelief. Aaron Zellin is a researcher in the Department of Politics at Brandeis University, and he tracks militant Islamic forums on his site, jihadology.net. He says that jihadis online were skeptical of bin Laden's death all week for a couple of reasons.
Part of it has to do with the fact that following the announcement, the Tariqi Taliban Pakistan, as well as the Afghan Taliban, released statements saying that they believed bin Laden was still alive. Another issue is that when Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was the former leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, was killed, they plastered the media with his photo.
I know the U.S. intelligence community is paying very close attention to the very same sites that you monitor, looking for intelligence or even code language to trigger new attacks. To what degree have new attacks been promised on the sites that you're looking at?
They're on the sites, that's for sure. These guys, even before bin Laden's death, are making threats almost daily. But I think most of the individuals that are talking about attacking the West, it's mostly suggesting others to try and go out there and do it. There's no evidence that they're talking about specific individuals or cells that are set up there. Though there was one individual in the Shmukh al-Islam forum, Abu Salimon, who stated that if we can confirm the death of bin Laden, then we will have cells ready to attack. But it's hard to tell what's a legitimate threat since the language is very similar every single day.
Was there anything on any of the sites that you frequent to suggest al-Qaeda and its 20 years of the most violent sort of mischief has maybe come to naught?
I've not seen any evidence of that. Those who already believe that bin Laden is dead cite how when the leader of the Arabs in Afghanistan in the 80s against the Soviets died, the jihad continued. And then they gave the example of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. He died and the jihad continued. So they still believe wholeheartedly that al-Qaeda will keep on going and that the jihad will continue and that in the end they will be victorious.
Can you give me some specifics of the rhetoric that you've seen?
Yeah, sure. I could give you some quotes. Please let them celebrate. They are celebrating their own end. Osama is in the heart of every Muslim, even those who don't admit it publicly. There are some disturbing ones such as, I'll cut the head of everyone who says Sheikh Osama is dead. And then there's this one that's interesting. Coming, O America, coming, O Jews, coming, O rejectionists, which they're referring to Shiites, coming, O Kufar, seculars and apostates. Arrivals are coming, and they are bringing the coffins with merciless devices.
Wow. Come, all ye faithful.
Definitely. They believe in this stuff. Even if it sounds a little crazy to us, it's not crazy to them. It's completely rational because they have a completely different worldview.
Okay. Aaron, thank you very, very much.
No problem. Thank you.
Aaron Zellin runs the website jihadology.net. Not long after the U.S. invaded Afghanistan in October 2001, CNN got a hold of 1,500 audio cassettes from the Kandahar compound of Osama bin Laden. They were passed along to U.S. officials who found them of no intelligence value and so passed them along to academics for further study. Enter Flag Miller, a religious studies professor at the University of California at Davis. He spent years translating and transcribing the tapes. We originally aired this interview last year, but his insights were so compelling, and they are once again so timely, we decided to rerun it. Miller told us that the audio cassettes contain more than 200 different voices, many of the Mujahideen who were intimately involved in planning attacks on Western targets in the years leading up to September 11th.
What's interesting in listening to the tapes is just how much debate there was even at that time, both about who was in charge, but also what the goals were of the militancy movement.
There is one tape that is labeled Osama bin Laden's 1996 Declaration of War. And this is a tape that we've heard before, but at some point in the tape, bin Laden veers off into poetry, and you think that that's significant.
Well, bin Laden in summer of 1996 was at the lowest point of his career. He was stateless for the first time, having been kicked out of the Sudan, where he'd lived for a good 6 years before that. He was stripped of his Saudi citizenship. He wasn't in position to declare war against anybody. And so in this speech, he has to kind of really ramp up the stakes of conflict with the West and somehow claim the mantle of leadership. Much of the first part of the speech focuses on legal arguments for why Muslims should individually sign up for jihad and fight the West. But he also confronts the bulk of legal consensus in the Muslim world that is strongly against individuals launching jihad wherever they are. So he has to back off of his legal commitments and say, well, in fact, there are other reasons. And he then comes up with some wild narratives about the ways in which Muslim youth today can fill the shoes of the companions who fought alongside the Prophet in the 7th century. And he then moves into poetry to rally the emotions of listeners.
You know, there's an expression in advertising, if you've got nothing to say, sing it. Is that what you're suggesting is going on here?
Very much that kind of thing. You know, poetry throughout the Muslim world taps deeply into cultural beliefs, into values. It's used by villagers. It's used by political elites. And bin Laden can cite poetry at ease. He composes his own verse. And frequently in translations of the 96 Declaration, this stuff drops out. But when you hear this poetry on audio cassette, you hear the intensity of bin Laden's voice. He's addressing William Perry, the former Secretary of Defense under the Clinton administration, in a challenge to man-to-man combat. And he says, here's what the Muslim youth say to you. Tomorrow, William, you will discover which young man will confront your brethren who've been deceived by their own leaders. And then he moves into a poem. A youth who plunges into the smoke of war, smiling. He hunches forth, staining the blades of lances red. May God not let my eye stray from the most eminent humans, should they fall. As the stallion bears my witness that I hold them back, my stabbing is like the cinders of fire that explode into flame. his vision for himself as a cosmic warrior who can transcend the constraints of time and space and take on the West is nowhere more apparent than in this material. And it's a material that speaks to cultural memories of glory, honor, tribal manliness, and dignity, broadly writ, for Muslim communities.
There is another tape in which you hear a bunch of mujahideen milling around the kitchen making breakfast.
Well, one of the tapes starts and there's a strange kind of static noise. There's some clinking, popping, and then someone says, air, 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 give it some air. Don't you notice that its voice is weak? It needs air, I mean, with force. So I'm listening to this, and I'm not sure kind of, they're pumping something up, like, is it some kind of communications balloon? And then the conversation continues. Someone else says, ooh, you see now, engineers are we. And it turns out it's a cook, and he's pumping up a kerosene stove to make eggs. He says, engineers are we, engineers of eggs. And they reflect on the fact that here they are, they've traveled from around the world, they've come to fight this glorious battle, but the battle has not yet begun, and there are days in which they're waiting for something to happen. And so isn't it ironic that here they are, jihadis in the kitchen?
Now, it must be weird for you to see these guys doing such human things, guys who would go on, some or maybe even many of them, maybe all of them, to be mass murderers. They killed thousands of people in 6 or 7 or 8 countries. And you hear them joking around. What is that like to see the human side?
One of the things these tapes teach us is the complexity of these individuals. And it's understanding the dynamism of militancy as a creative and adaptive strategy that will better allow us to defeat them. And that can only come through carefully listening to their arguments and understanding how they appeal to listeners as human beings and how they try as best they can to portray their more violent vision in sympathetic terms. That's difficult to listen to, but it's nevertheless important.
Well, Flag, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was great to talk.
Flag Miller is Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the University of California at Davis.
There is Osama bin Laden in his own words, and Osama bin Laden as we would have him. The Osama of our daydreams and the Osama of our nightmares. Here's a quick review of how we've dealt with the specter of bin Laden over the past 10 years. The Osama of daydreams is the one embraced by conspiracy theorists who base their views on what they believe are facts. To many of them, this daydream Osama is either still alive or long dead.
Now, the most common belief was that he died in the bombing of Tora Bora, the Battle of Tora Bora in 2001.
Chris Cunningham, writer and blogger of The Bazaar at professorhex.blogspot.com, has been following the bin Laden conspiracies.
But he also had a host of physical ailments, as we've been told for years, including diabetes and terrible kidney failure, that he was on dialysis machines. He had Addison's disease. Perhaps he had Marfan syndrome and even asthma. The idea that this man living in a cave someplace without access to proper medical care could survive as long as he did, to a lot of people, they just assumed that he was dead.
Who liked that theory?
Well, former CIA case officer Robert Baer said in 2008 that, well, of course he's dead. And a counterterrorism chief from the FBI, Dale Watson, said he thought he was probably dead. And a writer named Angelo M. Codavillo said, this is my favorite quote, all the evidence suggests Elvis Presley is more alive today than Osama bin Laden. Angelo Codavillo, I should point out, is a former U.S. foreign intelligence officer and a Boston University professor.
So there's a theory that he died in 2001. There's a theory, I guess, that he also died earlier in the Obama administration.
The new theory that you're seeing on all the message boards is that somehow either the Obama administration or the Bush administration had his body somewhere on ice, some sort of terror sickle, as I've been calling him, and they waited for the opportune moment to fake this entire excursion into Pakistan for fill-in-the-blank reasons.
Waiting for a politically opportune moment to, you know, trot him out.
Why is now a politically opportune moment? Now, if the Bush administration had had a frozen Osama bin Laden on call, I think he would have played that card when the economy was collapsing, if for no other reason to change the topic. And as to the President Obama, I think it would have been a better card to play at the beginning of his administration, which probably would have ensured him a much less rocky road to begin with.
Well, I'm just thinking, you know, isn't there any of these theories that you might embrace? Like, for instance, the one involving Donald Trump?
Oh, okay. You got me there. That one, I think, might actually have a little validity to it. If I was the president and I had the chance to interrupt the last 15 minutes of Trump's television show or wait 15 minutes, I'd probably interrupt Trump. I think most Americans would interrupt Trump. Don't you?
Chris Cunningham of ProfessorHex.blogspot.com. So much for the Osama of our daydreams, the Osama of our nightmares, the death bringer from land, sea, and air, has been punctured in his long absence by cheap laughs. Soon after 9/11, a Saturday Night Live sketch had him cowardly suggesting alternate plans to his comrades intent on flying into the Twin Towers. In the wake of the attacks, South Park ran an episode called Osama Bin Laden Has Farty Pants, where he's depicted as a kind of Warner Brothers' terminally unlucky Wile E. Coyote.
Uh-oh. Ah!
After he is reduced by Cartman to a toothless stupor, a soldier shoots him in the head.
Oh, I got him! I got him!
On Family Guy, a goofy Bin Laden tries to make a terrorist video.
This is a message to all American infidels. Prepare to die in a sea of holy fire. You will be punished for your decadent ways on the first day of Ramadan. You... wait a minute. Did I just say... What did I say? Ramadan? Ramadan. Ramadan. What is that? Maybe Dennis Ramadan is going to punish you with his crazy hair. No?
With like an extra bloopers clip.
Drew Grant is a pop culture writer for Salon.
And then Stewie comes in and kills Osama. You can see this becoming a prevailing theme in American pop culture.
I'm not going to be able to do it now. I'm not going to... Okay, all right. Okay, no, you know, I got to get all the laughs out. Okay.
So you could portray Osama bin Laden as a coward, and you could make jokes about him sending everyone else off into, like, the glory of Allah while he, like, sits in his, you know, whole mansion, cave, whatever, but you couldn't make fun of what actually happened.
Those jokes goading the specter of death gave us a pleasant frisson. They felt transgressive. They were for late night or cable. Here, that is. In the rest of the world, Osama jokes popped up in a far more cautious venue, advertising, and just as outrageously. Ad man Mark Duffy, who blogs at copyranter.blogspot.com, recalls a print ad made for Romania by the European headhunter Lou Gehrig and Mockler.
With a tight-cropped scene next to a computer, a man's business card just says City Airport and has Osama bin Laden, air traffic controller, with the headline, Right Headhunting Prevents Business Casualties. Yeah, that's like way over the top. I also found from China, J. Walter Thompson, a pretty big worldwide agency, did this ad. And it's an infrared image of Osama bin Laden holding a walkie-talkie. The idea being that he's using Hall's cough drops, and they have a cooling effect. The cooling power of the cough drops has made him invisible to infrared detection.
Now, there was an ad for a Dutch children's photography company?
Yeah, it shows a supposed young, looks like about 6-year-old Osama bin Laden in a picture frame, and the headline says, "Kids are cute, so treasure the moment."
Now, that's really deep.
Yeah. I guess that would motivate me to get some shots of my kids before everything goes wrong. You know?
What about the German pharmaceutical company that used Osama bin Laden to sell condoms?
Yes, this was in Germany, an online pharmaceutical company called Doc Morris. And they showed illustrations of sperm with the heads of various evildoers, as W. Bush called them. One of them was Hitler, of course, this being Germany. And they don't have eyes on the sperm. They just have the hair. So with Hitler, you have that, you know, that horrible comb over and, of course, his iconic mustache. And Mao, you had his bowl cut. And then Osama bin Laden, you had the turban and the very iconic beard. And the message being, who knows how terrible your children are going to be.
You need a condom to protect you from the potentially terrorist sperm of your
mate.
It's
basically an ad for don't procreate is really what it is. Just can't believe that it would be used to sell pretty much anything. I called it despotvertising because there seems to be a lot of, you know, Hitler, Stalin gets used.
Come, Mr. Taliban, turn over Bin Laden.
Come and we drop the bomb.
There are plenty more nightmares where Bin Laden came from. It feels good to imagine that this is the end of an era. But that really is a dream. We have an inexhaustible supply of fresh fears, and we'll always feel the need of a cheap laugh to chase them away.
We said, they, oh, kick your ass, then we won't come
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and executives protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org. The MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition, on the web at MetLife.org, and the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at Hewlett.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The term gamification describes the practice of taking the incentives and mechanics of games, like points or rewards, and applying them to something that's not a game. Think of credit card reward programs or grocery store purchase points. Alex Levine of the security consulting firm Kronos Global says Islamic extremist websites have borrowed from the gamification playbook by incentivizing participation in terrorist activity.
You post a comment or a news article, whatever you decide to post, and other people can thank you for your post. They can also give you negative or positive rep power or reputation power based on the amount of posts you're posting and the quality of your posts. Your community will give you rep power if they like your post.
What does rep power mean?
For most of these forums, the more rep power you have, the more rewards you can actually get. And the rewards are pretty trivial. You know, you can add a larger avatar or change the color of your username, but people are really engaged and want these prizes.
There is a competition, just as there would be on Farmville or Foursquare?
Absolutely. It's the exact same thing. If you're checking in on Foursquare, if you're playing Farmville, you're competing in a game space and you're experiencing gamification in the same way that these people are on these forums.
These have been adapted from a commercial environment. Nonprofits use these things as well. You noted in your article that the neo-Nazi site Stormfront uses these techniques.
What's so scary and dangerous about what we're seeing is that gamification works so well for corporations. Ultimately, what it does is it encourages loyalty among the consumers. And so if militant forums and Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups are able to use these same game mechanics, then what we're concerned about is that they're going to continue to engage their users and that there will be much more brand loyalty, that Al-Qaeda will be the terrorist group that these users will want to stay with. They actually, in the past few days with Bin Laden's death, I've seen some users say, how come so-and-so hasn't weighed in on this? I mean, there's a real community here. People really rely on their peers for answers. And the fear is that they'll find a way to communicate offline where law enforcement isn't necessarily watching and actually do something.
But you don't have any data that points to gamification translating into real-world violence, do you?
We're in the very beginnings of understanding this theory and how it applies to the jihadi online architecture. But there are some U.S.-based convicted terrorists who were very, very involved in the forums that employ gamification.
Give me an example of someone.
Zachary Chesser, he was a 20-year-old born in Virginia. Just last year, he boarded a plane for Somalia with his infant son, and he was arrested before he was able to go to Somalia to join the Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist group Al-Shabaab. He was very, very active on almost every forum out there. In particular, got his beginning of his online radicalization started on Anwar Awlaki's blog.
And explain who that is.
Anwar Awlaki is a prominent leader in Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. He's based in Yemen. And
he's American.
Yes, he was born in America and he lived in America for a long time before going to Yemen and joining AQAP.
And before his website was taken down, he inspired an enormous amount of loyalty through it.
The beauty of Anwar Awlaki is the way that he was able to employ gamification throughout his website without actually letting users know what he was doing. And perhaps he didn't even know what he was doing. He created a community-based forum where people were able to post about his lectures and reach out to him as well. There was a lot of people who would brag about the fact that Awlaki reached out to them and inspired them. He actually made himself the prize in this gamification world.
So without revealing any deep company secrets, what are you telling your clients to do, if anything, about these powerful tools that these websites are using that are potentially threatening?
Right now, we're in the process at Cronus of looking at game personalities. There's four different gaming personalities. There's an explorer, a socializer, an achiever, and a killer. And what we're trying to do with our clients, particularly the government agencies that we work with, is understand a person's gaming personality and predict what will happen in real life.
Who potentially they should trace of all Absolutely. The tens of thousands of people engaged in these sites.
Absolutely. And if someone has more influence, is that necessarily someone to look at or not? It depends on the individual and how to classify it.
Alex, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alex Levine is the director of research for the security consulting firm Cronus Global.
With Osama bin Laden's death, the United States has won a significant battle in the war on terror. But the U.S. is involved in another war, a global media war. A war that, according to a statement from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton back in March, we are losing.
I'll be very blunt in my assessment. Al Jazeera is winning. The Chinese have opened up a global English language and multi-language television network. The Russians have opened up an English language network. I've seen it in a few countries, and it's quite instructive.
These English language networks aren't aimed at audiences in their home countries. They're meant to directly challenge Western dominance over global news. Nathaniel Massey is one of 15 reporters from the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism who monitored five of these state-funded channels for a project called Global Media Wars. He says they looked at how the channels, Al Jazeera English, Russia Today, Press TV from Iran, France 24, and CCTV from China stacked up against one another.
For example, we would assess for credibility and rank them 1 through 5. If a channel was very credible, such as Al Jazeera, it was a 5. If it was much less credible, clearly slanted, such as Press TV out of Iran, it would get a 1.
It's an interesting selection of channels you've chosen. The Iranian channel is sort of like voice of Ahmadinejad. Al Jazeera seems to me to stand pretty much head and shoulders above the rest in terms of attempts at objectivity. And then there's Russia Today. How would you describe this channel?
Entertainment news. And the gist of that entertainment is making fun of the United States. Russia Today has an extremely confrontational stance when it comes to the U.S., and their content doesn't try to take itself that seriously. They've been very innovative in airing their content through non-traditional means. For example, via YouTube, they get a lot of views. And I think they tailor their approach to that audience, an audience that's looking for a laugh or an alternate viewpoint.
The Iranian TV channel, the Chinese TV channel, and Russia Today, though they have the look and the feel of maybe BBC or CNN International, it just because it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck doesn't make it a duck. Do their viewers think they're a duck?
I would hesitate to say that their viewers think they're a duck. I think any viewer who is exposed to multiple media forms in this day and age where there is such a plurality of information has some certain degree of discernment. And if you watch Press TV or Russia Today, you know from the get-go that they have an agenda. At the same time, there are, at moments, segments of those broadcasts which can be taken credibly. For example, if China Central Television produces a segment on something that has nothing to do with Chinese policy, it can be quite objective.
Did you follow the coverage of the bin Laden killing on these channels this week?
I did.
All right. Please go down the list. On Al Jazeera English, what happened?
Al Jazeera English came out right away, just like BBC and CNN, giving detailed information. They also had unique sources that CNN and BBC did not have. They had a Taliban chieftain saying, this isn't going to change anything, the insurgency will continue. They had a friend of bin Laden's in Saudi Arabia talking about bin Laden's earlier life and his transition. What came out of them was very interesting and very professional.
France 24?
It doesn't concern France or the Francophone world directly, so what you got from France 24 was much more bullet points. No particular slant one way or the other.
China?
China Central Television, same thing. What does bin Laden's death have to do with China or its immediate policy goals? There were some questions about, did the U.S. have the right to be there in Pakistan? Maybe more than you would see in the U.S. media.
Russia Today.
Russia Today. Russia Today first ignored the events for 12 to 24 hours. And
well,
then,
maybe thinking the whole thing would just blow over.
perhaps. And when it did not, what came out of Russia was first questioning the evidence that Osama was dead and then strongly condemning the U.S.'s action in Pakistan. And finally, as you can imagine, Press TV out of Iran, my favorite headline that they ran this week was, U.S. is balkanizing the Middle East. They brought on some experts, in quotation marks, saying, no, actually, bin Laden died 10 years ago. This is all a setup, part of the ongoing effort by the West to impose its will on the Middle East.
So we began this conversation, Nathaniel, talking about the global media war that the Secretary of State believes that we're not faring all that well in. Based on these five channels, do you throw in with Secretary Clinton?
No, I don't, because it's not so much that we are losing the war at this moment. It's just that we're no longer winning it hands down. The fact is that CNN International and the BBC had a complete monopoly over this arena for decades. What we're seeing is a new plurality of voices, and we're going to have to get used to that, and we're going to have to become more discerning because we can no longer count on there only being one or two voices that we can trust.
Nathaniel, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Nathaniel Massey is a student at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. You can learn more at globalmediawars.com.
Oh, television, one of the greatest machines ever invented. Not a year, not a day goes by without someone griping about its wasted potential. This seems to be a global phenomenon. But the chorus of woe was expressed most memorably, practically at the medium's birth, right here in the USA, 50 years ago this coming Monday, when then FCC Chairman Newton Minow coined the fateful phrase, the vast wasteland. WNYC's Sarah Fishko takes us back.
It was one of the most celebrated speeches ever delivered. Newton Minow, FCC Commissioner, was speaking to the National Association of Broadcasters Convention, May 9, 1961. Look what you're producing, he said to them.
I invite each of you to sit down in front of your own television set when your station goes on the air and stay there for a day without a book, without a magazine, without a newspaper, without a profit and loss sheet or a rating book to distract you. Keep your eyes glued to that set until the station signs off. I can assure you that what you will observe is a vast wasteland.
You're talking about the Gettysburg Address for broadcasters.
Mike Dann heard it. He was a programming executive at CBS at the time.
I can't tell you the importance of that speech.
The two words, vast wasteland, stuck like glue, remembers Minow.
The two words that I wanted to be remembered were not vast wasteland. The two words I cared about were public interest.
When it came to commercial broadcasting then, the public interest was not at the forefront. To understand the moment, you have to go back a few years to the earliest days of TV, says Brandeis University's Thomas Dougherty. It all happened so fast.
In the late 1940s, about 1 in 10 families in America have TV. By the late 1950s, and by the time Newton Minow gives his famous speech, it's like more like 9 in 10 families have television, and more families would rather give up their refrigerator than their television.
Newton Minow was one of those people. He was first in line to buy a TV.
The minute I saw it, I said, this is the most important invention since the atomic bomb.
Minow had been a lawyer and had worked for Adlai Stevenson during Stevenson's unsuccessful bid for the presidency in 1956. There, he'd met Robert F. Kennedy, and the two had discussed television and its impact on their families and the dismal state of things in the broadcast business.
Scandal of the year, the television quiz show fraud with Charles Van Doren, the pivotal figure.
There were the quiz scandals and payola scandals. Scandals at the FCC. President Eisenhower was forced to ask the then chairman of the FCC to resign. Things were really at a low point.
Distinguished broadcaster Edward R. Murrow had made a speech in the late 50s.
This instrument can teach, it can illuminate, yes, and even it can inspire.
It was a plea for TV to realize its potential.
But it can do so only to the extent that humans are determined to use it to those ends. Otherwise, it's nothing but wires and lights in a box.
The new frontier is here, whether we seek it or not.
And a vision for a broader potential was expressed by a new Democratic candidate in 1960.
But I believe that the times require imagination and courage and perseverance. I'm asking each of you.
Kennedy believed that government had a legitimate role to play in the development of a country's cultural life.
Marianne Watson, author of The Expanding Vista, American Television in the Kennedy Years, says the Minow connection had stayed with Bobby Kennedy and his brother.
And John Kennedy, the first appointment he made to a regulatory agency was Newton Minow.
The untouchable.
Minow's appointment to the position coincided with another development as TV audiences multiplied.
The series The Untouchables on ABC had become a big hit, and that kind of formulaic, violent programming was replacing a lot of the quality series. When I show it to students today, even today's jaded students are a little bit surprised at the, you know, just sprays of machine gun.
The distance between the power television has,
Thomas Doherty,
and the responsibility television is assuming is seen to be particularly wide by the early 1960s.
Clearly, at the heart of the FCC's authority lies its power to license, to renew or fail to renew, or to revoke a license.
So in that perfect storm of a moment, Minow walked out to challenge broadcasters to be better. He said it was a vast wasteland, but he said a few other things, too.
I say to you now, renewal will not be pro forma in the future. There is nothing permanent or sacred about a broadcast license.
The 39-minute speech was as direct as any FCC mandate had ever been.
Minow was saying, we're actually going to enforce this. There were consequences to pay, and that is something we don't have anymore.
Newton Minow was famous overnight. The public loved him, but broadcasters called the day he spoke, that Tuesday, Black Tuesday, remembers Mike Dann.
We were making money. The basis for American enterprise, whether it's selling cars or operating a broadcasting company, was the profit motive.
There was anger among broadcasters and fear.
Because we were concerned that Newton would be more aggressive after that critical speech. The speech was a bombshell. We had meetings in Washington. We had meetings with ourselves. Nothing like this had ever happened before.
What actually did happen as a result? That depends on whom you ask.
We thought it was an excellent speech, but I did absolutely nothing to improve the situation, and I know of no one who did.
Marianne Watson believes there was an impact, that social dramas like The Defenders, East Side, West Side, and similar series grew out of that regulatory zeal of the very public, very popular Mr. Minow. And of course, broadcasters had assumed there would be 2 terms, 8 years of such pressures. But it didn't happen that way.
The end of the era, the Newton Minow, the New Frontier era in regulation, is really when President Johnson takes office. He is a broadcaster. He identifies with broadcasters. Much of his family fortune is from radio stations. Lady Bird owned radio stations, and so they had a lot of money in broadcast holdings. So when he took office, his inclination was to ease off on government regulation of broadcasting.
Before that, it had looked for a moment as if things might change, as if the free market and the public interest might be reconciled in some way. In the end, the power of TV to resist regulation proved both vast and untouchable. For On the Media, I'm Sarah Fishko.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, and Sara Abdurrahman, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson, and she had help this week from Dylan Keefe and Wayne Schulmeister.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.